Now we're going to talk about a giant on the rugby field, a colossus in the boardroom, because on Saturday, Tony O'Reilly, Ireland's first business superstar, died at the age of 88. Much has been written about the boy from Dublin's north side, and my next guest has described him as arguably the most interesting non-elected public figure in Ireland over a period of about 60 years. Author and broadcaster Matt Cooper, good morning to you.
Good morning.
You worked for him. You wrote a book about him, The Maximalist, in 2015. What drew you to him as a subject for a biography?
He is one of the most interesting people that you would have had the opportunity to meet and then to actually write about. His story, in some respects, is almost like the stuff of fiction. There are so many twists and turns along the way, so many successes. And then ultimately, if you judge somebody by their financial net worth at the end, his bankruptcy would have made him a failure. But I think the tributes that have been paid to him in recent days will certainly let his family know that he was exceptionally highly regarded by many people who were very thankful for what he did for them over the years as well. And that the measure of a man is not necessarily by the amount of money that he accumulates, although he did have at a certain point a degree of obsession about being a billionaire and about owning lots of things.
They said of him in that statement announcing his death that he lived one of the great lives, and I don't think anybody would argue with that. Matt, will you talk to us about maybe the arc of his life from Kerrygold through the building of his Irish empire, Hines as well, of course, but the Irish empire, and then Waterford, Wedgwood, I&M and the decline?
It's a big story and it's a long story. And I just go back a little bit. I mean, just even mention his success on the rugby field. He would have been, rugby wasn't as big a sport in the national consciousness in the 1950s and 1960s, but he was the superstar of his era. He played for Ireland first as an 18-year-old as a winger. He then went to play as a teenager for the British and Irish Lions on two tours and became the highest try scorer ever for the Lions on those tours. And he had, also you could say he was like a Brian O'Driscoll of his day. That was the level of fame that he had. But then he moved that. He still was a very intellectual and able individual. He moved that. He became a solicitor, but then moved into business. And at a very early age, he took responsibility on board Bonya. And as managing director in his 20s, he created the Kerrygold brand to accelerate the sales of Irish butter internationally. And that was one of the achievements for which he was most proud of his life. And that's something enduring achievement, given that Kerrygold is still a major international brand. And brands were one of the big things that he always championed, although some of the sceptics would have said the biggest brand that he championed was himself. He certainly had no shortage of self-confidence, but he was terrific at actually dealing with people. And a lot of that he puts down to the interaction that he would have had with farmers when he was in his 20s, working first in Sutton's in Cork in agricultural inputs, then in Bourbonia, and then in the Irish Sugar Company afterwards, where Jack Lynch's Taoiseach personally asked him to go in and try and oversee a difficult situation in that company. That brought him to Hines. It brought him briefly to the UK, and then Hines brought him to the United States, where very quickly, as having been first chief operating officer, he became the overall boss, chairman, chief executive, president. He was the main man at Hines, and he was rewarded enormously for it. In 1991, he was then paid what was a record on Wall Street of $75 million for his performance in that particular year, an unheard of wealth on a stock market quota company. While he was doing all of this, he continued to have enormous interest in Ireland. He had it written into his contract with Hines that he could invest in Ireland. In the 1970s, he took control of what was then known as independent newspapers, with the Sunday Independent, Irish Independent, Evening Herald and Sunday World. He then also tried to find oil. He was very involved in a highly controversial company called Atlantic Resources, which went on an oil hunt in Irish waters in the 1980s. He continued to build his Irish businesses through a company called Fitzwilton, and then in 1989 invested in what we would always regard as Waterford Glass or Waterford Crystal, but was a bigger entity, Waterford Wedgwood, with the ceramics company in the UK. And that went well for a while. But ultimately in the 2000s, it did not go well. Mismanagement of production and of marketing, and it lost hundreds of millions of euro. He pumped lots of his own personal money in. His brother-in-law, his second wife, Peter Galandris, he had married for his second time to Chris Galandris, he put in hundreds of millions. All the money was lost and the company went wallop. And at the same time, he lost control of independent news and media to Dennis O'Brien.
Yes, and in the telling of that, Matt, yes, in the telling of that story of INM, talk to us about the relationship between these two men and the fierce competition that eventually led to Tony O'Reilly in that confrontation, if we want to call it that, coming out the loser.
So this sort of enmity went back to, in the first place, Tony O'Reilly was an unsuccessful bidder for the country's second mobile phone licence back in the mid-1990s, which was awarded to Dennis O'Brien amidst considerable controversy subsequently. Then Tony O'Reilly managed to win control of Aircom, along with others, at the expense of Dennis O'Brien in the early 2000s. Many of the issues in relation to that were rankled with Dennis O'Brien. And when he became exceptionally wealthy from his Digicel business in the Caribbean, he decided to invest in buying shares in Independent News and Media, which was a public company. Anyone could buy shares in it. And much to O'Reilly's astonishment, O'Brien managed to build a shareholding as big as his in the company. Simultaneously, in the years of the crash, advertising revenues shrank dramatically. Also, newspaper sales fell, and the value of Independent News and Media, against which O'Reilly had borrowed money, fell dramatically. This left suddenly the billionaire in 2008 with lots of debts to service that he didn't have the assets to cover. And he lost control first of the business to Independent News and Media. And then AIB decided to call in a 22 million euro loan that he had taken out at the height of trying to defend his position in Independent News and Media. And when they pushed him for repayment and he couldn't meet it, he ended up being declared bankrupt.
You, I think, in your book concluded that he was a financial illusionist. Explain.
Well, he certainly depended on debt a lot of the time to build his assets. And that was fine when the valuation of the assets was bigger than the debt. But when markets changed and when assets fell in value, then he left himself very vulnerable to having to repay the banks and those from whom he had borrowed. And that had happened a number of times during his career. What many people would have felt with Tony O'Reilly is there were so many aspects to him, but they would have felt in relation to the financials that he always strove for more, that he could have just been the boss of Heinz and he could have had a very considerable lifestyle and he would have been able to enjoy his wealth tremendously, but he always needed to have more. He needed to do more things. This might have had something to do with the circumstances of his upbringing, because this mightn't be an unusual story now, but it was when he discovered in 1950s Ireland that his father and mother were not married, that actually his father was married to another person, another woman, and had four children. And he hadn't been told any of this. And he was told of it by a priest in Belvedere College as a teenager. And he didn't say it to his own parents until many, many years later. And his first wife, Susan, certainly was of the belief, and she only discovered after they were married and they had had their six children, that he was in this position, that he was driven by this need all the time to have more, hence why we called him the maximalist in the book.
Matt, just finally, briefly, the legacy, the Ireland funds?
I think that he very much so. Himself and Dan Rooney in the 1970s, he came to know Dan Rooney in Pittsburgh when he was working in Heinz. He was very concerned about the rise of the IRA and also by its fundraising by NORAD in the United States. He felt there was a need to raise more money in the United States for Ireland that could be given to peaceful projects north and south of the border. And the Ireland Funds, which continues to operate today, did outstanding work in that regard over many years. So while many people would have complained about his use of the power of the newspapers for political interference in Ireland, and that is something that still rages on in some quarters, certainly in relation to his legacy, what he did in the Ireland Funds, along with being an extraordinarily individual, is one thing that he'd be remembered for.
Matt, thank you very much for assessing him for us this morning. That's Matt Cooper, presenter of The Last Word on Today FM.